This is Joyride. In this podcast series, we'll be exploring some of the most iconic cars in history. I, Jared Brandon Flandy, will be taking the driver's seat as your host. Please sit back and enjoy the ride. Well, 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 welcome back to another episode of Joyride. Now, with this episode, I'd like to say I have another guest on this time. He's my good friend and car enthusiast, Adam Mindenhall. How you doing, Adam?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, other than being just a friend and a car enthusiast, Adam is also an actor, I'd like to point out.
Yes, thanks to you. Yeah, I had a great opportunity to be part of Half-Life of a Genius and representing the great Raymer Schreiber during that film, which was indeed an honor.
Yes, the Half-Life of a Genius physicist Raymer Schreiber was my directorial debut. It is a documentary that featured some early NASA efforts as well as the Manhattan Project, and Adam portrayed the young Dr. Raymer Schreiber. If you wish to check out the movie, you can see it on Amazon Prime as well as IMDb TV, and it's also available for purchase on Blu-ray and DVD on Amazon as well. So aside from that, at the end of each episode, Adam, I always give a hint to the audience what the next car will be. And I said it had a odd distinction of being both American and Irish, and it only came in one color. And if anyone guessed, it's the DeLorean. Yes, you are right. Now, one of the reasons why I have Adam on today is Adam at one point was a proud DeLorean owner.
Yes, I was. Indeed, it was an experience and a lot of positive moments, more so than negative by far.
Now, you've told me this, but tell everyone else how old you are when you first purchased your DeLorean.
So I was the age of 16 when I first purchased my car, which is younger than most, but it's something that I had my eye on since I was nearly about 6 years old. From the first time I saw Back to the Future, I was absolutely obsessed with the car. It made a huge impact on me. In fact, a lot of ways, it really sparked my overall interest and drive initially in automotive, and it just grew from there. So yeah, that's where it started.
I know. When he first told me that, I was like, you suck. You had a DeLorean in high school. I mean, how many people could say that?
A lot of people can't. I mean, honestly, a lot of people didn't think it was even my car. You know, they thought it was my dad's or relative or something of that nature. But, and again, I think a lot of that was when people see that car, it really does capture the imagination and attention to the level of a Ferrari or Lamborghini or an exotic that's far more expensive. And so many people that don't know a lot about the car just immediately assume that it's very expensive, which it's not. It's not out of reach. And even at the age of 16, it's something that I'd saved up for a number of years. And by all means, there were people I went to high school with that had cars that were much more expensive than that DeLorean that I had. So funny how that works.
Oh, I'd believe it. Now, who'd you buy it from?
So I bought it from a car collector in Arlington, Washington, and forgive me, I can't think of his name right at the moment, but he had it privately listed. Actually, it was on Craigslist that I originally found it, and he had a number of cars. Some of them were quite impressive, equally to the DeLorean. Also, he had a very interesting and impressive Indian motorcycle collection, some which he had in his house. Anyhow, he was the third owner of the car, and it had only 10,750 miles on it when I purchased it from him.
Wow, that's quite not a lot. Now, we first met, like, I don't know, probably 10 plus years ago, and we were both working for my dad's company. But we've had this discussion. I think we met actually before when I was like, you would have been like 19, I would have been 10. But I think I remember me and my brother were talking to you when you were driving your DeLorean down good old 3rd Street in McMinnville, like early 2000s.
Indeed, you know, the more we've talked about this a number of times, but honestly, it does spark a memory because I do remember being parked on 3rd Street And a couple people, it would have been you much younger at the time and your brother approaching me and asking about the car. And yes, I mean, it's crazy. You know, it's like an episode of The Twilight Zone. Who would have known years down the road we would have met later and so forth and became friends. But honestly, I do vaguely remember that. And the more I think about it, the more details come together.
I know. I do remember that you had another younger guy with you. And as he drove off, he gave us a hang 10 out the window. And you said, I think that was Chad Murrow.
In fact, I'm almost absolutely certain it was Chad, because one of the, and it would have been a rare time. And in fact, that time on 3rd Street would have been the first time that I brought the car down to Oregon. And I did indeed take it to Chad's house and took him for a ride. And one of the places we did go was 3rd Street McMinnville. So I'm pretty certain that's exactly who it was in the car that day.
All right. No, that's a good start to things. I'd like to remind everyone out there that's listening is that due to the, we're having to practice the social distancing because of the coronavirus, we're all doing this remote via Skype. But as I've said before, we're doing what we can. So that's just about the end of it there. So, all right. Are you ready to hear the story of the DeLorean, Adam?
Indeed, I am. Please proceed.
Okay. Now, this was my idea when I first started with this, and you and me kind of talked about this before we sat down to do this, is that a lot of these DeLorean stories, most of what they focus on is the whole cocaine scandal. And I've always been disappointed with that because that's just such a small fraction of what happened.
It really is. I think it's overshadowed by that scandal due to John DeLorean and his essentially celebrity status at the time. He was such a high profile person, and the people that he interfaced with were as well, especially his wife. So I think that's why it's just so overshadowed. One of the reasons anyways.
Yeah, I realize that aspect of it kind of gives it the scandal and the sex appeal. But this time I really didn't want to focus on that. I really wanted to focus on the man in the car and everything that went into it. So that's what we're going to be talking about.
Excellent.
All right. Okay, so with that said, here we go. The DeLorean blasted its way into existence in the year 1981. However, this is only one small fragment of the DeLorean story. The origins of the legendary stainless steel car would begin decades earlier and ultimately was the dream of one man. John Zachary DeLorean was born in Detroit, Michigan on January 6, 1925. He was the son of Catherine DeLorean and Zachary DeLorean. His mother was of Hungarian origin, and John's father was a Romanian immigrant who would eventually settle in the state of Michigan. He had very little formal education, which prevented him from securing a skilled job in the United States. He would eventually become a union organizer for the Ford Motor Company. So, John's already off to a good start. He's in Detroit. We all know what's going to happen now. I mean, at that time, you're bound to get involved in the car industry because it's just at its heyday at that point.
It is.
Yeah. So John was the oldest of four sons the DeLorean couple would have. Unfortunately, John's father was an alcoholic and was known to have been abusive to his family. The DeLoreans would divorce in 1942. With time, Zachary would move into a boarding house where he would eventually die from his drug addiction. So, yeah, not the best start in life for him, I think.
Indeed, it was not. Yeah, he had definitely very, very meager beginnings.
Yeah, and in when you kind of hold this in consideration, you can see why he was so driven when you think about it, even to like a reckless level.
I think that's, you know, that's a hallmark that's found with a lot of great people. Many of them came from meager beginnings or nothing. You know, Henry Ford is a prime, you know, comparison in a lot of ways. And again, having that hunger is what causes them to have the drive.
No, exactly. I've always wondered for years, like, what is the origin of the DeLorean name? Because aside from the car being cool, I mean, just the guy's name was cool. So I had no idea that DeLorean is a Romanian name. So, yeah, there's a little fun fact for you.
Oh, interesting. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. So the DeLorean children would live with their mother in cities such as Los Angeles before they returned to Detroit. During his growing up years, John harbored a desire to become a musician. His musical abilities would provide him the opportunity to excel with his studies while in high school. But being from the Motor City, he would eventually become attracted to the automotive industry. Now, that I didn't know either. I had no idea that he dreamed of being a musician at any point.
That is another really interesting fact as well, yes.
I'm not sure what he played, but I guess whatever he did, he was really good at it. I mean, that's how he got into a really good school, just because he played so well with the different bands he was involved with.
Indeed.
After high school, he would attend a university where his engineering prowess was starting to become apparent. However, his time in college would be disrupted when he was drafted into the Army during World War II. He would serve for 3 years before being honorably discharged. When he returned from the war, he discovered that his mother and siblings were not doing financially well. He returned to college, but also began working for Chrysler part-time in order to help his mother and siblings during this difficult period. Now, that's pretty common these days, and unfortunately, it might come even more common with the possible recession coming up, but he had to have been, like, I think he did something very noble there, but he had to have gotten some flack for, you know, still doing, living at home and trying to help his family at such a young age.
Oh, no doubt. Especially that generation, you think they were even more so, you know, get married, have children, that kind of thing, and not the reverse, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, by all means.
Yeah, it's that whole you got to be a man type thing. But
yep.
So in time, John finally completed his degree in industrial engineering. After graduating, he would secure employment not with Ford like his father, but instead with Ford's largest rival, General Motors. I'm sure Dad was not pleased to hear that.
No, not especially not where he was from.
No, exactly. But he probably did it on purpose for all we know, since his dad was not a very good father. It's like that was the ultimate F you, Dad. I'm going to go work for GM.
Yeah, really. It would have been. And in that era, especially. So.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone doesn't know back then, I mean, it still is now, but like, you have Chrysler and the big three, but it really was Ford, GM. Those were the titans of the business back then. So it was a very strong divide.
It truly was. It absolutely was. More so by far than today.
John would quickly rise to the ranks at GM. During his tenure at GM, he would invent the concealed windshield wiper and the modern radio antenna for cars. I had no clue. I did not know he did that.
Wow. Yeah, the antenna feature, actually, that's also interesting. I wasn't aware.
His engineering skills gathered the attention from the executives of the company to the point he was offered to be head of one of the GM divisions. Now, usually, from what I understood, it usually took you years to be the head of a GM division. You were like ancient old by the time you got there. I mean, you were probably not just almost retired, but almost dead pretty much. And he did it in a very short time. Yeah. Yeah. Consequently, at 40, he became the youngest division head in history.
Gosh, that really is something when you think about it. Wow. God. Yeah, the amount of time it takes, you know, an average person back then to climb the ladder. Look how quickly he did it, you know, and again, just being of that age. I mean, having that kind of drive, that says something.
And aside from that, too, on top of it, they basically told him, you can choose any division you want. They just didn't say, oh, you're going to be in charge of Buick or whatever. And so they went, just pick one. GM's business strategy was to offer a car brand to the consumer that would fit any lifestyle or pocketbook. Early in life, you'd start by owning a Chevrolet and hopefully be able to afford a luxurious Cadillac later in life. Pontiac, on the other hand, at this time, did not have a brand identity, at least a strong one. Which is why John chose this division. He saw this as an opportunity to show the engineering abilities that got him the job in the first place. It's funny, this sounds inspiring, but it's kind of funny to think that Pontiac's not even around anymore.
It is, you know, and they were such a contender and a label back then. I mean, what an established brand it was for many years. And now, I mean, yeah, today it's really crazy to think. I mean, it's just, people today wouldn't even know what's Pontiac. You know, any of the young people coming up today not seeing that or being around of age wouldn't even know.
Yeah, and Pontiac, I can't remember the exact year, but it got phased out during the Great Recession when GM was going through all the financial problems. And back then, from my understanding, is that all these different brands of GM, they all used the basic parts componentry, but they all were pretty autonomous from each other.
Yes, yeah, they were. It has changed quite a bit, actually, in that fashion, where things are much more specific to the model today.
I mean, basically anymore, at least up to like the last 10, 15 years, a GM car is a GM car. They just slap a different badge on it.
Yep. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yep.
So John's landmark project during this period is when he took a Pontiac Tempest and dropped a powerful V8 engine into it. This car would be known as the Pontiac GTO. Although this title is debatable, the GTO is considered to be the world's first muscle car.
Yeah, that is a big debate, and you know, it kind of made the biggest impact. I mean, people can talk about that all day, of course, you know, being the first and not the first kind of thing, but it really did make an impact because the average American consumer could buy a car that looked like just a regular car, but have that kind of power plant in there. And again, the performance spoke for itself. So that was a really big deal of its time.
Now, I may have seen one at a car show at some point, but it doesn't really stick in my mind very well. Have you ever seen one?
Yes, I have. I've seen a number of them with and without engines, but I have seen the actual era of Pontiac that John DeLorean had dropped that engine in. Yes, I have. And it's interesting. I mean, when you see ones that are unmodified, that they're just bone stock, they do kind of speak for themselves. I mean, it again, not having that extra flash, and just, I mean, it was a good looking car, especially for its era, and it maintained the subtleties of a regular car, but having that performance. In a lot of ways, some people might consider it being one of the early sleeper cars just because of the option that was available there with that power plant.
No, that's all very good points. So consequently, the car sold incredibly well, and Pontiac and Chevrolet were selling over 3 million cars by 1971 to John's leadership, which from my understanding was a lot more than Ford was at that time.
Wow.
Yeah, so once again, like, F you, Dad, for the second time. As the oil crisis hit in the 70s, he even wanted the company to produce smaller cars, much like the foreign manufacturers were already doing. He even called out GM for the poor quality of some of their products. Now, I thought this was particularly inspiring because I think this is where the American automotive industry has really hit its first slump, even long before it has in more recent times. They just can't get in their mind that you can build a small car, that everything has to be huge for this market.
Yeah, it's hard to really pinpoint why that is, but that certainly has been the ongoing trend for years. And in my personal opinion, I'll just throw it out there. I think it's otherwise ruined models that would be good cars just by the inflation of the size, or just the, again, things are overdone, I think, in a lot of ways, to where they could be done more slimline, and instead it's the super size me, the bigger better deal, and it's not always the bigger better look, in my opinion.
I mean at that time you had, of course, the Volkswagen Beetle was well into production by that point, and then the smaller cars were coming out of Japan, and this is really when the Japanese started to take over things, because since gas was so high, these smaller Japanese cars were just so much more fuel efficient, and really they've slowly started dominating even that far back.
They did. That's very good. That's a good point. You know, especially Honda and Toyota both. I mean, those were cars that, you know, in some retrospects, I mean, they were a little bit more than the American model, but the more people that started purchasing and driving them realized the value and reliability, especially with the fuel economy. So
exactly. So keep continuing on here. At this time, automotive executives were some of the biggest celebrities of their day, and John became the most famous. At one point, he was even earmarked to be president of the company.
Yeah, you know, that's a good, interesting observation anyways. You know, I don't know if it falls into the realm of politics or just, you know, again, you think back then, people had radio and TV. They didn't have all the social media we have today. Right. And yet, in a lot of ways, they knew more about these people than we do today. So it was just interesting how things were kept in the spotlight. And I think it was just a focus on certain things, maybe, you know, for example, I mean, automotive was a very driving force and there was a lot of continuing change. And I think maybe as a result of that, it was just more coverage in the news, where today, you know, we hear more about things we probably care nothing about more times than not, than things we might deem in more important or relevant. So.
Mm-hmm. And I talked to my mom about this because, you know, she was around back then. And I went, Did you know, I mean, like, I'm not talking about, you know, the car and the cocaine stuff. Did you know about John DeLorean before that? And she went, oh, yeah. I mean, everyone did. I mean, that's just how famous he was. And he wasn't a movie star or anything like that. He was a guy that worked for GM, which I just think is astounding, you know?
It really is. I mean, yeah. And that goes to say, shows, you know, that says something. I mean, he didn't have to be a person that was a gearhead or, you know, directly into automotive, per se, or motorsports. You just heard about him because he was that wide. He was, you know, that well covered. One of those individuals.
Also, by the way, as we keep getting deeper into this, the name DeLorean is used a lot. I mean, you have John DeLorean, DeLorean Motor Company, the DeLorean, the different family members that have that name. So I'm going to start referring to the car as the DeLorean. I'm just referring to him as John to keep them clear and separate. Is that all right?
Yeah, that sounds that's good. I think that'll really help with the focus because you're right. It is extremely overdone in the subject matter just naturally.
Yeah. So as John was becoming more successful with his inventions, he began to reinvent himself. GM was a very conservative company. So when John started coming into the office not wearing a suit and started wearing a shirt that was halfway unbuttoned, this did not go over well with management. I mean, he was literally just kind of doing like that whole 70s Hugh Hefner thing, you know, gold chains, you know, just kind of the stud thing, you know, which did not fit in this very Mad Men world, obviously.
No, and you know, with John, it's a very interesting from, you know, a visual standpoint, his progression because of the era he was born into and how he rose up. You look at the early John and it was the high and tight haircut, you know, that classic 50s, 60s, super clean look, executive. And as time goes on, as we get into the late 60s, into the 70s, well, his look dramatically changes. I mean, it's still very, you know, professional, but it does change dramatically with the times. So he's a great representation of that.
By this point, what I thought was hilarious is half the photos he was in for publicity stuff, he's just totally shirtless and nothing, wearing nothing but a pair of jeans, like leaning against a car.
Yeah, you know, that is true. And with the actual DeLorean, you're right. There, when you look at some of the early photos, even, I mean, there's ones that he's in his suit and everything else, and then there's a number where he's just not. I mean, he's, like you said, shirtless or just in very relaxed gear.
Yeah. So there were even instances where he would take the company jet on a Thursday, fly out to Hollywood to party, and then roll back into the office on a Tuesday. I'm sure that did not go over well, but you know that would not happen, period, now.
No, it would not.
John had already been married and divorced twice, but in 1973, he married Christina Ferrer, the top supermodel in the world at the time. Now, out of any point in the story where a comment has to be made, I think it needs to be made here. Okay. This is like Elon Musk, an unknown Elon Musk, 15 years ago, marrying Heidi Klum out of the blue.
Yes, actually, that's a good comparison. You know, someone that's that, I'm kind of at a loss of words at the moment to describe it, but forward thinking or progressive. And then again, marrying or being associated directly with a very high caliber female of that level. Yes, it's an interesting association.
So if anyone who's not very familiar with this story, I'm not going to give you a spoiler. I'm just going to give you a warning. Things do not end too well for this guy. So now would be the time to just kind of start coming down a bit here, because it's going to get even more wilder and worse. Just wait. So I know you know half of it. Because of John's playboy lifestyle, he would depart General Motors in 1973. To this day, it's still debated whether he was let go or he quit. He says he quit. GM says they fired him. Well, it's going to be lost to history, but that's pretty much where it gets left at.
Yeah, I haven't really. I mean, as far as any ironclad details, no. I think it's one of those things that if, you know, needless to say, if John would have stayed on track, he would have stayed. I mean, GM would have kept him on. It was because of his alternative thinking and the direction he was going. If he would, they really were grooming him to be president of General Motors. And, you know, again, debatable whether he quit or he was fired. That was a big thing for GM. That was a big loss because they had a lot invested with him and he was such a rising star. They really wanted to see him, you know, ascend to the highest level. But unfortunately, John made some decisions that did not rub them well, I guess you would say.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it. With this newfound time on his hands, John decided to build the car of his dreams. He envisioned his car to be a fierce rival for the BMW CS. One of the first prerequisites, it had to be built from stainless steel to prevent rust, which was a common fault of vehicles of the era. In 1974, he approached the design house of Ital Design and insisted Giorgetto Giugiaro would be the one who styled his new car. Do you know much about Giugiaro, Adam?
I do to a point. He did design a lot of amazing body styles, especially for Ferrari, to my understanding, and some other car makers. So he was a very choice designer, needless to say, and very futuristic, you might say, as well. Definitely out of the box.
I mean, yeah, he really is like the Tiger Woods of car designers. I mean, he's done all the way from Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, the Lotus Esprit, and you can actually see the similarity between the Lotus and the Esprit and the DeLorean, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he also did like even simple cars. Like, I think he designed the first Volkswagen Golf on top of it.
Oh, I didn't know. That's interesting.
Yeah. Now, in my Lamborghini Mirror episode, I mentioned Giugiaro as well. And so I find funny, there's all these connections. And I also mentioned John in the Mustang episode. So John DeLorean kind of like is the automotive Forrest Gump. He just keeps popping up when you least expect him to in automotive history.
That's a good way of putting it. He is. It's amazing how connected he was, you know, beyond his own direct creation, all the things that he actually contributed to the automotive industry
exactly. And
where it went.
Now, with a design in place, there was only one small problem. John needed to raise a mere $200 million to build the factory and start the company. Yeah, that's easy to do, right?
Yeah, especially in that era that we're falling into now. Yeah, that needless to say, especially going off by yourself as well, you know, trying to do that, which was, he really was the first since Henry Ford to kind of go, hey, I'm going to start my own car company and I've got a great idea and now I need people to back me.
I mean, the only other example would have been Preston Tucker, you know, with the Tucker 48, and that's a whole episode in itself, but ultimately he even wasn't able to do it either.
That's a very good point. And Tucker is often overlooked. And in fact, I just, you know, overlooked him myself. So I'm glad you mentioned that because that really is an episode on itself. And he was the only other one that kind of falls in that category.
During John's time of partying in Hollywood, he became friends with Sammy Davis Jr. and Johnny Carson, who he convinced to both invest in his new car company. This was only just the start of what he needed, though. He then came to the realization that a foreign government may provide enough subsidies to pay for the construction of the factory. He initially came close to striking a deal with the government of Puerto Rico, but at the last minute, the British government gave him a better offer. The Labor Party was in power at the time and was being generous with state subsidies in order to support new businesses. When we kind of were discussing what we're going to talk about this, Adam, you really wanted to kind of talk about some of the economics behind this. Do you have any comments on this particular situation?
Again, the era that this fell into, there were a lot of challenges due to the, you know, the way the economy, especially the global economy, was at the time. And mind you, as we near, you know, get closer to 1980, we're dipping into a major recession as well. And So there are just a lot of challenges that when he first started to get ram up, it didn't look terrible, but a lot of challenges just due to what's going to come next kind of thing.
Now, from my understanding, a lot of people just thought he was crazy for doing this, dealing with a foreign government, you know, especially in this time where people were, I think, were a lot more patriotic than they even are now.
That's true. That is another thing. And to it kind of contradicts someone of his stature that has such a strong American background. I mean, VP, you know, of GM, General Motors, and their prodigal child, you might say, in some ways, it really does. It kind of just, it's like somebody turning to the dark side, so to speak, from the American point of view.
John was offered one more lucky proposition. Instead of building the factory in England, it was decided that it should be built in Belfast in Northern Ireland. Since Northern Ireland was at the peak of their troubles, the unemployment rate was well above 30%. In other words, John would not have any trouble finding a steady supply of workers for his new factory.
And that was definitely a major a major appeal to that particular area and putting manufacturing in was just the willingness of the people and the willingness of the government to allow manufacturing to come in to boost their own economy. So that was definitely a great appeal.
Now, while we're on this note, I'd like to point out something is that at that time, even though you had all the IRA stuff going on in Ireland, the problems in Belfast are not nearly as bad as everyone seems to think they were. In fact, they were even going, John, why are you doing this? You're building your factory in a war zone. And even he pointed out, like, Detroit's murder rate is like 100, not literally, but like 100 times more than Belfast's is.
That's a good point.
There was problems, but it really wasn't that bad. In fact, I've been told, I think I went to a talk by Rick Steves, who is the noted travel book author. He said, according to him, that not one American tourist had ever died in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Northern Ireland was not a war zone. And in fact, I think at times it's been voted like one of the safest cities in the world, like since the 21st century has come around. So I don't think he was making a bad decision by having it there is my point.
No, at the time, absolutely not, when you look at those details.
So, with everything in place, the financial figures were now finalized. The British government agreed to pay 120 out of the 200 million. This meant that with every 100 pounds the British taxpayer had to provide, Johnny on his end only had to provide 1 pound.
Wow. Aren't finances amazing?
I think that worked out to his advantage very well.
Yes, indeed.
Originally, there was a long list of other proposed ideas for the car as development continued. The car was supposed to be mid-engined and was to feature a rotary engine. John also insisted that the car would have ample cabin space for tall drivers since he was 6'4". Okay, I really want to consult you on this because you and me are both well over 6 foot. Is a DeLorean comfortable for people over 6 feet tall?
So yeah, I am. I vary in height depending on the shoes, right? But I label myself as 6'3". Some people call me 6'4", but I'm basically the similar frame to John DeLorean. You know, as long as you have the seat adjusted properly, I would say yes, it does. And the reason for that is not just the headliner, but more so the actual the room on from your hip or on your side against the door. With the gullwing door design, it actually does give you a good amount of space. And I'm talking a nice solid about 12 inches, it feels like, between you and the actual edge of the door. So that's where it really makes up some room. Where other cars, like Corvette, for example, of its era, or even a Porsche, you get in and the door is just right there. So you're and again, the seats, the way they're designed on those cars are a little different as well. But you feel more just kind of crammed in, where the DeLorean, it's hard to kind of explain. You got to sit in one to experience, but with that gullwing door design, it really does open things up on the side, from the side room that you have, and you're able to shift around and move more so than you would in other cars.
I've never driven one, but I was at a car show. It was a nice young guy that had it, and he let me sit in it. And that's the first thing I noticed. It was like, wow, I actually fit in this thing. I didn't expect that.
Yes. Again, the general amount of space is more so than most of the cars, I would say, of its era, at least the ones that were in that class competing against the DeLorean. Again, you just have to adjust things right in there. Anyone shorter than like I am, it's even easier as far as room goes. Yeah, again, I thought it was very well designed, especially for its era. And the interior, it's pretty well contoured, where today I guess some people would say it's dated to a point, but still not as much as the cars of its era by any means. The DeLorean was definitely a car apart on its own, especially with the way it was designed on the interior.
No, you're right, especially with a lot of older cars like that. I think I have sat in a Mini Cooper convertible, and literally I couldn't drive with it with the top covered because my head literally stuck above the entire windshield as we were
going. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, as the development of the car progressed, most of these original ideas had to be thrown out. The rotary engine had to go, and the Cologne engine from Ford was the next choice. Eventually, this was also omitted, and finally, the chosen engine would be a joint Peugeot-Renault-Volvo engine that was not in the middle, but in the back of the car. And that's, I've heard that's been referred to as the PRV engine, right?
Correct. That is the PRV6. Yep.
What now, did any Volvo vehicles use that as well?
Yes, and we'll have to add back in the model. But yeah, that was featured in, I think it was the Volvo 260, if I'm not mistaken. And that was, again, that was a car that traditionally is a four-cylinder engine, and that V6 was put right in the front. And I think those were available on Volvos from 1980 or even 79, perhaps, to 84, somewhere around there.
So there's another fun fact for everyone. The DeLorean featured the same engine that was also in some Volvos. I wouldn't have guessed that. And a Peugeot, you know, and a Renault.
Literally identical. But as far, the only differences on that setup are the airbox, just because of the different engine compartment design. And other than that, it's the identical engine. I mean, all the parts are interchangeable. That's really the only big difference on the two.
So the one thing that did stay, though, from the original design was the gullwing doors. And that is probably, if anyone has not seen one, that's probably the most noteworthy feature of the car, of course. The doors that both come out on either side.
Absolutely it is. And I think the DeLorean, till this day, is still the most well-designed gullwing car, just with its proportions. And now that's probably a biased point of view because I'm a former owner. But there's a number of cars that do look good. You know, the Mercedes-Benz 300 SL Gullwing, that's one of the most iconic early ones. You know, the Brooklyn SV1, you know, that's more of a Corvette kind of silhouette car design. It had gullwing doors as well. But the DeLorean, they did it right. That designer truly designed it very well.
The car was originally going to be called the DeLorean DMC-12 because the cost of the car was going to be $12,000 in order to be affordable. But because of the design changes and early production problems, the car's price skyrocketed. It was now in Ferrari and Porsche territory, which was not good news since these companies were both producing much more powerful cars.
Yeah, that was a big hindrance, I guess you would say, because now you had a car, and we can get more into the engine later, but you had a car that had a, at best, kind of mediocre engine, especially with who it was competing with, you know, the likes of Porsche, Ferrari, Corvette. And the price point now was much higher than expected. So that was definitely made people kind of scratch their heads a little bit.
Just a bit, I would think, you know, at the very least. So to add to these woes, even more production problems occurred. John knew he needed help from an outside company other than his own. He would turn to Colin Bruce Chapman, who was the founder of the Lotus Car Company. Lotus would design many aspects of the car, including the DeLorean suspension. Now, is that correct, Adam?
Yes, that is correct. Yep, they did.
Back at the factory, things were going good, though. Many people in Belfast were excited to have a job and worked very hard, even though few of them had any automotive experience at all. In contemporary interviews, some former DeLorean employees said it was the best place they had ever worked at.
Yeah, that's what's interesting. Again, that's something you really kind of have to dig for today to find some of that information. Like we were talking earlier, you just, you know, it's the cocaine scandal or things associated directly with that. And it takes you askew off the core, you know, story when it pertains to production and just the car itself. Forget the scandal, trying to separate the two. And a lot of the workers, and there's people till this day that still talk, you know, that reflect on their time there. Especially people that were factory trained technicians that didn't work right in the factory themselves, but what a positive environment it was and how exciting it was because of the car and just the design and again, the future. I mean, John really had some, I mean, big ideas. And before things started to fall apart, you know, there was a lot of indication that it was probably going to be going that direction. I mean, I hate to throw someone like Howard Hughes in the mix, but you know, a lot of people that worked for him in his golden age, it was an exciting time because he was so progressive. And it's just like, you know, it was fun to be a part of something so forward thinking and unlike anything else.
No, I think so. And everything I heard, John had a bit of an ego. I mean, that we can't really brush over that. He wasn't exactly a saint. But from what I had heard in some of these interviews, I mean, he was very personal with the employees still. Like, if he heard 6 weeks ago that someone was going to have a baby and they had the baby, he would go to that person in the factory and shake their hands and go, you know, congratulations, that whole kind of thing.
You know, that's a neat old school thing that's lost, I think, today, you know, with people of his level or comparable today. They're more so a picture on the wall of an office or a building somewhere or a boardroom versus there's the person, you know, actually making personable engagements with their employees.
Yeah, and I think that's something that definitely needs to come back, to say the least.
I agree. The corporate model today has lost that. Yep.
So with Lotus assisting, the DeLorean parts management team was now set up in Coventry, England, the automotive center of the United Kingdom. With components in mind, it was suggested the car should have electric windows. The gullwing doors proved to make this difficult. This is why the car features the infamously small electric windows. Now, since you've had to deal with this on a daily basis, what is life like with those tiny little letterbox windows?
it's quite interesting. You know, they were nicknamed the toll booth window, essentially, especially for all the toll booths that you encounter over in Europe, if you're driving the car in the countryside or so forth. And so it works well in that respect. But, you know, you go to like a drive-through restaurant to get any type of food, especially a drink, it just doesn't work. In fact, most DeLorean owners, if you're behind somebody at a McDonald's or Burger King or something in a DeLorean, they open their door to get the food. You have no other choice. It's just easier. And it always sparks conversation, needless to say, with the people handing the food or drink off to you because of the car itself. It's always entertaining.
And, you know, I bet that's hard to a certain degree because, you know, it's like you want to be supportive because they're excited to see the DeLorean, but you're just like, I just want my hamburger. Can I go now, please?
Exactly. And so just to kind of not to go off on a tangent a little bit, but the window thing is very interesting. In fact, DeLorean had made the choice to go with electric to, you know, entice more features. And again, it was a challenge with the gullwing doors. But again, to be more competitive and to offer those features, because that's what other cars that were in that bracket, I mean, they featured electric windows, for example, and he wanted to compete with that. Originally, it did not have electric. It had sliding windows, and it was a different design. And the sliding windows were much more functional in the respect of if you were at a drive-through, there was enough space with that gullwing door design, with that sliding window, to get food in and out. You wouldn't have to open your doors. And so that greatly reduced the functionality, even though it's electric, which, again, to offer more features made sense. But as far as the usability and function of that window, it reduced it dramatically.
Well, at the time, electric windows were considered a cool thing. You know, it wasn't standard by any means, you know.
It wasn't. And it's interesting because if you look at the early DeLorean prototypes, like the 1976, it features those sliding windows. Now, as you get later down the road, he had more prototypes that basically reflect the production model itself. I mean, almost identical. And in 1980, some of those final prototype cars before the actual production model, they still featured that sliding window. In fact, I had an opportunity to purchase one of those cars before I bought my car. And hindsight's always 20/20. I could have purchased that prototype DeLorean, which wasn't in as good a shape, but it would have been for the same price. And today's value, it would have quadrupled. That thing's worth a lot of money today, and you can't find those prototype cars. So mind you, this is going back a few years, 1999. And I remember looking at the car, I believe it was either in California or Nevada. And it was in running condition, but it had some disrepair in the interior and so forth. But it was one of those true 1980 last prototype cars. And it's really neat because it featured those sliding windows still. So that's a whole other thing.
All right. So John had the intention to produce the car or to get it ready in 2 years. Instead, it would take him 5. The DeLorean was supposed to debut in 1979, but it would not until 1981. When the first cars would be available for purchase. In order to bolster some needed attention, the DeLorean Motor Company would make a deal with American Express. Now, what was this deal with American Express, Adam?
So the American Express promotion, again, I forget some of the fine details, but they had produced three 24 karat gold plated DeLoreans, which also featured a custom brown leather interior and dash to match. And it was a promotion in regards to boosting people, you know, to get their credit cards and banking, go with them. You could actually win one of those cars. One of them was kept by a bank in Texas to put on display. In fact, they were one of the main banks to help promote that promotion when it came out to house that. And the other two are in private collections today, but I believe, and we have to look at the facts again, I believe only two actually went up for to be won by people. And I'd have to look at details. I can't remember if they ever were. I think they ended up just going in private collections after the fact.
So as things continued, unlike Elon Musk with Tesla, John was not known to be very hands-on with his company. He spent most of his time at corporate headquarters in New York, where he enjoyed a hefty salary. Unsurprisingly, his spending habits did not change from his GM days, and he was now living in a luxurious apartment with his family. John and his previous wife had adopted a son, Zachary, and him and Christine had a daughter named Catherine. When the car was released in 81, it received rave reviews for its stylings, but got mixed reviews in other ways. For example, the first model year had a small alternator that could only produce 80 amps, which caused the battery to die early. As a result, many customers would become trapped in their cars since the gullwing doors required electricity to open.
Yeah, that is a little fun fact right there.
I would not be happy if that happened to me right when I bought it, like within the first 3 days. I'm stuck in my car.
No, needless to say, not. Yeah.
Things did not improve, though. Because of the constant production problems, the company started to hemorrhage financially. By 1982, the company was near the point of bankruptcy. The Conservative Party in Britain had taken power and was not as generous as the Labour Party had been with subsidies. John became desperate for money. Via social connection, he was able to become involved with a high-level cocaine operation. All right, we got to talk about it a little bit. It's part of the story.
Yep. So.
In October of 1982, he met with other cocaine dealers at a hotel. The meeting would end with the arrest of John DeLorean, since the entire meeting was a setup by the FBI. Ultimately, John would be acquitted of all charges due to entrapment being framed. But it was still not enough, and still too late to save the company. Before the factory was shut down, 9,000 DeLoreans had been built. It's estimated about 6,000 are left today. Are those facts approximate, Adam?
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, they are. And I think the 6,000 remaining today, I think it's less than that. That figure has been out for, I want to say, the last 15 years or more. In fact, I think it's been more like 20 plus years at this point. So, yeah, it's hard to say. You know, today I would conservatively think, you know, due to the nature of the car, there's still between 5,000 and 6,000 left. Yes.
You know, what's really frustrating about this, too, though, is I guess some of his executives have managed to get a loan set in place, and he could have signed it that day before he made that cocaine deal, but his ego got in the way and he didn't want to be seen as a figurehead. So he passed it down.
It really is frustrating from a lot of angles. You know, he was, again, just looking to finance his company, to keep things floating. And unfortunately, it involved something of a highly illegal nature, needless to say, the cocaine. And it's kind of a really loaded subject because you can look at it from a lot of angles. And I still believe there was some input to intentionally frame and make him fail just because of how progressive he was. He was way ahead of his time. Just looking back at how quickly he climbed the ranks at GM, the car itself, if he would have had even a few more years, it would have been amazing. It's hard to think in an alternate universe where that car would have gone. And like everybody says, and I'm sure we'll touch base on this in a minute, but if only he could have felt, you know, held on literally for a few more years, because where that car was going to go in pulp culture was going to immortalize it forever. And needless to say, if he would have been producing cars at the time, I think he would have sold those things like hotcakes, even for the price they were at that time.
No, I think so too. And if the company had managed to stay afloat, there were also plans to build other vehicles, including a four-seat DeLorean, an off-road vehicle, and surprisingly, even a bus.
Yeah, the bus is interesting. I've only heard about that a couple times vaguely. The four-door going car was also very interesting. There's a lot of concept art. Now, there's people that have actually made it, basically stuck two DeLoreans together and made a four-door car. In fact, I think the individual, you can look him up on the internet, you can just Google it, but the individual that did that originally also made a DeLorean monster truck as well. So pretty interesting stuff out there.
Yeah, I've seen that picture, yeah, of the monster truck. Fortunately, the company does exist in one way to this day. Stephen Wynn from Liverpool, England, would buy the DMC name and the remaining parts inventory and formed a new DeLorean Motor Company in 1995 based out of Texas. They've been building refurbished DeLoreans for a number of years, but there are also plans of returning an updated version of the car back into production. Now, I know they've been working on this for years. Have you heard anything? Have they gotten any further with that?
You know, I haven't heard anything definitive on, like, what's the date. I know you can still purchase cars one-off. As far as having that entire production line done, I am not sure where they're at. I haven't really heard anything different than what you just said. But you can still purchase one that's essentially a new car. It was built from remaining parts, from ground up. There's upgraded options. For example, those engines were considered dogs in a lot of ways with the 130 horsepower engines they had today. If you were to order a car, they can produce the same car, naturally aspirated with an upgraded camshaft, higher performance, around 200 horsepower, I think is what they offer today. It's the same engine, just higher power output. And they fix all the problems the cars had with the overheating, electrical issues. You essentially get a new car and in the best way possible, the most upgraded functioning DeLorean you could have today for a price, mind you. And again, I'm talking out of line here a little bit because I'm going back a few years, but I know when they originally offered those, they were around $50,000 to $60,000 for a truly refurbished or newly built DeLorean from old spare parts.
No, that's my understanding as well. So hopefully they keep working on that.
Yeah, hopefully so. It'd be really neat to see because it's amazing how many parts were left over. So it would be really great to see those go back into production and build what they can out of the remaining parts.
No, I'm excited for certain. All right, we're approaching the end of our story here. So John and Christine, after all this occurred, would eventually divorce and he'd become a born-again Christian. Mr. John Z. DeLorean would end up living in a small apartment in the later years of his life. Despite the previous failure, he spent the rest of his life with the hopes of building a new car, but this did not come to fruition. John DeLorean would die in 2005 at the age of 80 years old. Even though the man may not be with us, his legacy lives on to this day in the car he built, the DeLorean. All right, so what did you think of that story, Adam?
I think it was, you know, a good synopsis, essentially, from start to finish, you know, the rise and fall of John DeLorean. And again, just the legacy the car leaves behind. Again, that could be expanded on, needless to say, but it really kind of a good breakdown and something that focuses more on the character himself versus the overwhelming abundance of the cocaine scandal, which most people think of or hear about when you initially look in the John DeLorean.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, there's lots of little extra tidbits that you can keep going into. I try to make these relatively concise, so that's why I kind of cover those topics. On that mind, though, in some of these episodes, I'll talk about the movies that cars are featured in. So when it comes to the DeLorean, let's just get the big elephant in the room out of the way. I mean, if anyone has no idea what we've been talking about, it's the car from Back to the Future.
You couldn't put it more simpler than that. I mean, if even people that weren't born in 1995, their parents or their grandparents have shown them that movie now and should know what that is.
I mean, that's the thing. That movie, it's aged extraordinarily well, despite being from the 80s. I mean, I've hardly met anyone that hasn't seen it.
Really, and I haven't either. I mean, honestly, unless you're completely shut off from TV or media of all types, living in a monastery, for the most part, you do know what that movie is, and you've at least seen the first one or the second one or at least one out of the trilogy. So,
and there's a couple other films that have been made about the DeLorean, John DeLorean. One of them is the documentary Framing John DeLorean, which features Alec Baldwin in the reenactment sequence. Have you seen that one, Adam?
Yes, I have. And, you know, that one I thought did an excellent job with the car itself, just with the visuals of the car. I mean, there were people that had the prototype cars in their private collections. They were brought back for the film. And so from a cinematic point of view, I thought they did a great job. You know, it's worth watching. Alec Baldwin, I thought, did good for Alec Baldwin. It's hard to get a person that looks identical to, you know, the person you're trying to represent. And that, in this subject, it was John DeLorean. I think he struggled a little bit with the height because John was a tall guy. And when you saw John DeLorean walking amongst other people, he definitely stood out. But overall, I thought it was a fairly well done film.
No, it is kind of similar to the one we both worked on too, where it was a documentary, but we got those kind of more elaborate, you know, reenactment scenes in there too. So I appreciated it for that respect.
Yes, exactly.
The other one that was made very recently was the film Driven. It was not a documentary. It was a narrative film. Now, in that one, I was particularly, I liked Lee Pace's. I mean, I thought Alec Baldwin did a great job, too, but I also like Lee Pace's performance as John.
Yeah, I would have to say I like Lee Pace's performance a little bit more. Just, again, going to back to the representation or the visuals of the person, he had more of a frame, his taller frame. I thought it did a better job of representing John DeLorean than Alec Baldwin did. But, you know, there's pros and cons to each one. But overall, I would say I'm preferable to him just representing John as a person. So,
well, the reality is, John, at that period, you have to be the most cocky, slightly arrogant, likable person on planet Earth, which is what I think Lee Pace did a good job of delivering on.
I agree. Yeah, that's a lot of marks to hit on, and he hit on all those. Yes. Yeah.
On the note of the movies, too, have you ever ridden the Back to the Future ride at Universal Studios?
Well, yes, I have. Now, I haven't in recent times, but geez, let's see. The first time I would have been 12 years old, and then the second time I was 20 years old. In my early 20s, anyways, went back and wrote it again. And, you know, of course, got to look at one of the actual cars from the film that was on display there and so forth. And it was a lot of fun. I think when I was 12, it was quite an experience, especially for the technology of the day. I mean, it really felt like you were flying, you know, in that IMAX experience.
It was pretty cool. You know, aside from, you know, John's ego, which obviously caused him a lot of problems, I've watched a lot of interviews with him later in life. And it was a very different man from what I saw in those interviews. He seemed, the best way I could put it is, he seemed sincere with the mistakes he made. So I don't think he was a con man. I don't think he was trying to pull, you know, a giant con anyway. I think he really wanted that company and that car to go, and it just didn't work out.
Absolutely. I mean, his heart and soul truly was in that car. And again, the direction and the dreams he had for it, I really think he had envisioned them coming to fruition. And when they did not, when he finally hit the roadblocks that he couldn't get over, it was truly heartbreaking for him as a person.
And in Framing John DeLorean, they interviewed both of his kids, who are now grown, of course. And from my understanding, they both lived just regular lives for the most part. So that car was hard on that family.
It really was in so many ways. And even the kids, when you watch some of their interviews, they talk about how hard it was to see their dad, even though once he became a born again Christian, you know, living in a one bedroom or two bedroom apartment at the end, it was hard for them because this was a guy that was a CEO that ran started his own car company. I mean, it was international, and it was a hard adjustment for them to see him in that light, even though John, it sounds like, had made peace with himself at that point. But what a huge roller coaster adjustment in lifestyle and just status, I guess you would say.
Hey, the way I look at it, ultimately, he didn't fail because here we are talking about him.
Truly, that's one of the things. And this car is in many ways a loaded subject, but it's one of the few vehicles or few things from automotive history that truly, I mean, even John himself, I don't think, you know, would think that in the year 2020, we'd still be talking about that car from 1981 to 83. And that really truly does says something, that it's immortalized in the fact that it still captures people's imagination today, whether you've seen the car or not. What's interesting about this particular car, again, there's certain things that date it to its 1980s era, you know, the taillights, the headlamps, for example. But aside from that, it truly is one of those designs that captures people's imagination and turns heads today no different than it did when it came out in 1981.
You couldn't have put it any better, Adam. So with that said, I think we're going to start wrapping things up. I just want to remind everyone that this is the season final for the season one of Joyride. So I think this was a pretty special one to do it with. By all means, tell anyone you know about this podcast so we can keep it going, as I usually like to say at the end of these. Also, by all means, check out The Half-Life of Genius Physicist Raymer Schreiber. That is on Amazon Prime, as well as IMDb TV, and Blu-ray and DVD on Amazon as well. And most of all, thank you, Adam, for coming on to the show and giving all your expertise about the DeLorean.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. With that said, thanks much, and stay tuned.